everyone. Welcome to Let's Talk About It with Dora Sherry. Get ready for some...
It's time.
It's Dora. Let's talk with Dora.
Let's talk about it.
It's Dora.
Come on, y'all, let's talk about it.
Let's talk with Dora.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Let's Talk About It. I am so excited about tonight's guest. Can't wait for you to meet her. If you look in the dictionary for resilience and powerful women, it would definitely be our guest tonight. If you don't mind, I actually wrote my introduction to her. She is the author of the powerful memoir, Go Ahead and Kill Me. How's that for a title, huh? She's a woman who refused to let her past define her future. Today, she's not only an author, but also a successful businesswoman, a CrossFit athlete, and someone who's passionate about encouraging others to overcome life's toughest challenges. Please join me in welcoming Siobhan Morse to the show. Siobhan, thank you so much for coming on tonight, for taking this time to let us get to know a little bit about you. Woo, is our audience in for a wild ride, girl?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Really grateful to be here.
You were on my radio show too, People Helping People.
Yeah.
And you were one of our favorite guests. Not just us, but the audience too, the listeners too.
Yeah, that's so great. Thank you.
Yeah. So Siobhan, go ahead and kill me. Woo, damn girl. Where did that title come from? And can you tell us a little bit about the book? The story, what inspired you, and a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So Go Ahead and Kill Me, the title came from... So I guess I have to tell you a little bit about me to get there. So I'm 20 plus years in recovery. Last 8 to 10 years of my addiction, I was living on the streets of Miami, and I was injecting heroin, I was smoking crack, and I was prostituting and doing just all the things you do, you know, when you're homeless, right? I didn't start there. Like, it took time to get there, but I got there. Years ago, there was a rapist. There was actually a series of murders of prostitutes happening in Miami. And the police had didn't really put together that there was a serial killer. They just saw these as one-offs. And this, you know, those free newspapers that used to be everywhere. Well, this one pointed out, hey, look, these are all prostitutes. They all worked the same area, et cetera. And so it was the A Street. He was dubbed the A Street Rapist. And what he would do is he would pick up a prostitute, take her someplace, cut off her head, and leave her body parts in different places. So I was prostituting, and they didn't really know about the A Street Rapist yet, but I was picked up with a guy who basically at a certain point pulled a machete out of the trunk of his car. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie Seven, but I thought he was going to do that to me. I thought he was going to rape me with the machete. And I was like, uh-uh. And I literally just held out my wrists and said, go ahead and kill me. Just do it like that. So that's where it came from. That's where the title came from.
Oh my God, Siobhan, I can't imagine any of that, let alone, oh my God, how just horrified and just how terrifying and horrifying that would be. So
what's really interesting is that, to be honest, I don't even see that as the worst thing, in my addiction, like as my bottom, like my emotional bottom in addiction was literally walking down the street and being terrified that nobody would pick me up, that nobody wanted me. Right. Wow. So you know, when you talk about all the things that I do and I've done or whatever, at the end of the day, like most addictions are about, especially opioid addiction, which is, you know, a big part of my story. But all of it, right? From the first toke off a marijuana joint on, right? First Boonesberry Farm, you know, Tickle Pink wine. I don't know if you remember that, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. Then,
it was all about managing the pain of being me. You know, I couldn't pinpoint the pain. And if you had asked or even told me you're in pain, I'd have been like, no, I'm not, I'm fine. But there was such a terrible, mean, awful, like, conversation in my head. And I really didn't have, like, the words to articulate it. But what it felt like all the time, right, was you're never going to be good enough. You're never going to get it right. You're always going to be less than. Look at how great everybody else is. Look at you're not that. And so I, you know, when we talk about belief systems and all of that, that's what that is. That's that, you know, background music that even though you don't hear those words, those are the feelings, at least for me. Right. And so it was always about like just trying to feel like everyone else seemed, you know, I didn't know that anyone else was, you know, that this was maybe some of it was even normal teenage angst. Right. But I didn't know that.
Wow.
And it just, you know, over time, you know, so I was like the overachiever and all of that, but I was never good enough. Never good enough. Nothing was ever good enough. And so, you know, it's a progressive disease. And I had some really significant trauma over time, like before and then during addiction, et cetera.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that also, you know, that changes the way that we process information.
Yeah,
right.
It sure does.
You know, trauma is a brain injury. It's not an illness. Yeah. It is a brain injury. So, all of that, you know, mixed together, I had to, you know, it started here and it just continued to progress. And it, gosh, 30 plus years I was doing drugs, you know?
Wow. Yeah, 38 years for me on the opioids. Yeah. I can never say that. You would think I'd have that word down pat, wouldn't you?
Right? Well, we weren't saying that when we were doing it.
yeah, that's for sure. So you said you were an overachiever. What started you into prostitution and how old were you?
So, So just a little like history. My dad was a surgeon. My dad was a World War II pilot. And he went to the war and did, you know, all of that so that he could get the GI Bill, so that he could go to medical school, because he grew up in absolute abject poverty. Yeah. His mom, at the age of 12 or 13, came over through Ellis Island all by herself. Her entire family had been killed, right? So, I mean, he just grew up in absolute abject poverty, and he was going to become a doctor. So he went through all of everything he went through. And so he was that greatest generation, right? And then he became a surgeon. And this is at a time when we really, as a world, right, got widespread access to antibiotics and to anesthesia and to all the things that make successful surgery possible, right? The first, you know, wave of doctors who could do this and not just kill people, you know?
Yeah.
You know, he, right. And so he was that kind of person, which is great. And he saw the way that I frame it for myself now is he saw how great he thought I was. And he wanted me to be that great. He wanted me to show up that great all the time. Yeah. Right. So he was kind of hard on me. We'll just leave it there. Right. So, right. That kind of begins that early childhood trauma, but it also sets the stage for me being very performance oriented. And if I do well, if I do this, if I do that, right, then I will get what I need.
Yeah.
So, I was all American athlete. I had a 3.0 Like, this is before, this is back when 4.0 was as high as you could get. I get like a 4 something now. I don't even understand that. But so I had like a 3.8. Yeah, right? I had like a 3.8 average in, you know, high school, and I was an All-American athlete and scholar, and I got a partial scholarship to FSU and, you know, all of these things. Even, you know, later on, I was in who's who in American colleges and universities, and, you know, I was the only one accepted to a PhD program that I applied to, and blah, 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 right? So it was just a series of overachieving things. And so anyway, it was a point at which I was, I had already begun smoking crack a lot. I was doing a little bit of heroin, but not that much. And this is pre ubiquity of fentanyl, right? The pre fentanyl era. So there wasn't a lot of that out there, thank God. And I was teaching a class at a university, and every time I taught the class, I just couldn't wait for it to be over, because I just kept thinking, I want to go smoke more crack, right? And they don't pay me good, and I want to make more money, and I want to, you know, blah, blah. So I quit teaching at the university, and I began to, I went and got a job dancing. I was like 32, got a job dancing on stage, stripping. And then it was just, you know, from there to house calls, out calls, blah, 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 blah. And eventually just walk in the street.
Wow. It just takes one thing to start it, doesn't it? Start the dominoes.
Yeah.
Made you take that first drug, that first hit? What were the, who gave it to you? I don't expect a name, but what were the circumstances?
It's okay. There was just these neighborhood kids. And my sister was there, and she's probably passed it to me. I don't even know. But years later, she said to me, I meant for you to get high, not stay high.
Yeah. We never know.
Because I was just like, I found it. Right.
Wow. So let's get back to the guy with the machete, because I'm totally fascinated with this. How did you get out of it? How did you get out of it? What happened?
So I do have a scar here from the machete where he held it. He ended up raping and sodomizing me, but like I had given up. I figured out he was going to kill me at some point. Like I didn't know there was no A Street rapist at that time. I didn't know for years. years later that's who that had been. And I was not involved in the case against him, but I really kind of gave up, and I didn't cry, and I think it was just like ruins for him. And it may have been very early in his career before he killed the women. I don't know. Most of the women that he killed, it apparently was in his car, or it was a little bit different. He let me live. I don't know. I honestly don't know. And I took the blood from here, and all of this happened in a schoolyard, like next to one of those little portable buildings where they hold class, like an elementary school. In like the shadows at late at night. And I wrote, I was raped here, and I put a date using the blood. I wrote that on the side of the building. I'll never forget that. Yeah.
Siobhan. Wow.
I know.
Wow.
And he went back across the field, and he told me that he would find me and kill me if I didn't wait till he was gone. So I waited till he was gone. And then I'm like all dirty and bloody and a mess. And the only way for me to get out was this giant fence, unless I went behind him. And I wasn't about to do that, even if he was gone. So I climbed this fence, and I'm about halfway up the fence, and a police car comes by and shines the light on me, and I recognize the officers. And they kind of look at me for a minute, and I thought about telling them what happened. And then I realized they were going to be like, so you didn't get paid? Like, how do you get raped? Like, what does that even mean?
Did you, like, right? Trash?
Didn't well, matter. No, that's what I assumed would happen. I was like, forget it. I'm not even going to say anything. And they just kept driving. And I literally went, and even looking so terrible, I went back out on the street, and a guy in a Porsche picked me up, and I made some money. and I went and got high.
Wow.
After they closed, got high. Yeah.
Wow.
I remember thinking, you're not going to take this away from me. This is my street. This is my city. You know, I remember thinking that.
Wow. Did the police officer not notice the blood, the cut?
They may have, they may not have. I don't know. I don't know that they care at that time.
Did they know you were
a very turbulent time in my memory? This was a very, yeah, and they knew I was crackhead and all of that. So.
Wow. Wow. So how did you get into recovery? What inspired you? What happened that brought you?
So the state of Florida offered me 5 years of accommodations, and they just thought it'd be a really good idea if I stopped doing drugs. I had about 26 felony arrests for possession of drugs and paraphernalia. That was like, you know, but I had already done a year in jail.
Wow.
And I was arrested 3 times in 1 weekend. I mean, it was ridiculous. But because I was arrested, they let me go. They realized they had a warrant. They came and got me. I mean, it was so stupid. I had already done a year. And the judge was going to send me to prison. And so I ran away to treatment.
Wow. Good. Good decision, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Turned out. Yeah.
So you've been clean now. How many years did you say?
So I have 20 plus, about 20 and a half years in recovery. Yeah.
Wow. So tell
clean
us.
And sober. Yes.
I know that you have a badass job right now. And I know that what a powerful woman you are. So can you tell us how you got from prostitution going into recovery to telling us what you do today?
Sure.
And how basically.
I mean, so yeah. Yeah, so I already had a master's and I had done PhD work in health service management and policy. And I had done work when I was a teaching assistant, actually even during my bachelor's, finishing up my bachelor's, but during my master's, I had worked with one of the professors and on a National Institute of Mental Health demonstration project. So I learned a lot about statistical analysis, publishing, running like programs, and I actually taught program development and evaluation. I had also my family, my dad ran a clinical pharmacology research unit, and I helped him with that. Like I coordinated studies for all the big pharma. I ran the first estradiol patch studies that were ever done. That's how long ago that was. I was like 19.
Bro, you're telling me.
Working with him. Yeah. And I was in nursing school, right? Long time. So I did a lot of that. And so I understood research. So I had this degree, I understood research. And after I went through treatment, I just kept showing back up at the treatment center. Like I didn't know what else to do with myself. So I would do that. And I would work a little bit for my dad. I would go there and I got the judge to approve that as being someplace I could do my community hours at the treatment center. So I would volunteer and I would do hours there. And I was just helping. And then they're like, well, we can take you on and give you like 10 hours a week to work. And then it turned into 20. And then one of the owners, it was a small, you know, just a single treatment center. One of the owners noticed me kind of. And so I helped him. I figured out how to do it. And I helped him set up an online school, like courses. If you were getting licensed in mental health or addiction counseling in the state of Florida, we had a series of electives you could sign up and take that we had online. And all sorts of different holistic things. And I would do little mini studies and present on them, you know, on the on how these things were working, different modalities, not your normal modalities, you know, things like sound therapy and drumming. And, you know, we did all sorts of stuff like that. So I would do that and I would go to conferences with him, and he often would present, and somebody would ask him something. I'd be in the back of the room and be like, "Hey, Siobhan, answer that." And the whole room would talk. Right. And so I got used to it. So eventually he's like, had me sit up on stage with him. So I got used to that. And anyway, a larger network of treatment centers, the CEO, needed a director of research. And he asked me if I would move to Tennessee and take that position. And I did. Wow. And we had a consultant from UT, a man named Sam McMaster. He's amazing. And he now runs the National Institute for Behavioral Health. But he and I were able to just figure it out. And between his academia and ability to publish and helping me with the statistical analyses and that, and then my just like logistics of here's how I want things to go, and the company being willing to give me the resources to make it happen, we were able to do what like no one has ever done. We had 5 years worth of 1 year results in like over 60% of the patients who came through our treatment centers.
Wow.
Right. And so we could basically, you know, put out like, you know, there's no guarantees, but 60% of the people who come to our treatment centers, here's the results they get. And we didn't just look at abstinence. We looked at things like how many days in the last 30 did you have like a serious conflict with your mom?
Yeah.
I mean, every mom that's calling the call center wants to know, am I going to get my son back? Am I going to get my, you know what I mean? That yeah. type of thing. So we had answers to those questions.
Wow.
And so I became kind of known as like the research lady. and they, you know, went through conferences and I was all over the place presenting, and we got like 15 publications in 3 years, and we just kept going and going. Right. And a huge company, a big Fortune 300, top 300 healthcare company in the world. Right. Came and bought us.
Wow.
And so I'm the sole remaining person from the original group in terms of the executive team, but I eventually moved up and began just being sort of special projects and research for them. And so I get to do things like design and support new, like we opened a whole opioid use division as a wow. result of work that I did with our chief clinical officer, trying to really say, hey, hey, hey. And I mean, we also, the company's so big, we have the behavioral health division. We also have like regular medical division.
Wow.
And I'm like, you know, things move slow, right? But
yeah.
I'm getting yeah. like protocols rolled out in our medical hospitals for initiating medications to help with opioid and other substances in our emergency rooms. And like I've worked with the liver transplant team, right? And one of my big things right now is also peers, like peers of the future. There's workforce issues that we need to address. Peers are going to help with that. But also, we know that the single biggest predictor of positive long-term outcomes is length of engagement. That's not yeah. length of stay. Right. I don't talk in terms of length of stay. Length of stay is about heading to bed. That's not it. There's evidence that shows that it's not about intensity. It's more about length. Right. So the longer people stay involved, and because we're so big and we have hospitals and clinics and, you know, all the different pieces, we can offer continuums. And that's yeah. kind of part of where I'm trying to integrate, like, support integration, but yeah. also being able to say, if you show up at our emergency room, you can get help. If you show up at our crisis center, you can get help. If you show up at our urgent center, it doesn't matter. There is no wrong door with us. If we are in wow. your community, we will help you. Right. Wow. And I know, like, and this isn't new ideas, but I think the average, and we're, you know, a big for-profit, shareholder-driven, right, company.
Yeah.
So bringing all of this and seeing it, and I think, you know, I'm not the only one with these ideas, you know, but like just, I just kind of keep pushing and bothering people and rolling these little boulders uphill, you know, and just rolling these boulders uphill and bothering people, like, honestly. You know, I'm a used car salesman. Hey, did you do that yet? Hey, can I come see you? Hey, could we talk about? Hey, could we, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and so peers are a really big thing for me right now. I mean, I'm very interested in that. We just opened, we have now 4 opioid treatment programs, specialty programs for opioid treatment. And I, when I proposed my model, I was like, I don't want to just be an OTP. Yeah. Right? We're not going to be like methadone distribution. Yes, we will have methadone, but we are going to offer psychiatric services. We are going to have groups. We're going to go beyond what federal guidelines say. We must have peers. And I want to integrate primary care, medical care. So we haven't really gotten our own primary care doctors, but what has happened is many of our clinics have, they have local mobile medical care buses come by every week.
Oh.
Because our patients need to, you know what I mean? When somebody first gets into recovery, those first several months, several years even, right, can be just like, you know, how there's the post-acute withdrawal syndrome, which is, you know, you have difficulty sleeping, emotional regulation. I mean, everything's out of whack. And so when someone is discharged, let's say, or when someone goes into treatment and they're handed a piece of paper that's like, here's all the other things you need to go do. It's like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm on the bus. What? You know, and it's really demoralizing and you feel like you're already going to fail. So a lot of times you do. You just give up.
Yeah.
So being able to offer as many services in one place is really, I think, key to helping people and you know, and then having peers there to engage them. Like, I know, I was there. I got you. I totally get it. Right?
Yeah.
That type of thing. So I think that's the engagement, you know, back to like this idea of keeping people in service longer.
Yeah,
and support. It looks different for different people. It looks different for different models. It's there is no wrong way.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever works is the right way. Whatever works for you to get you clean and keep you clean is the right way. But that's support.
Right.
Is everything.
Well, yeah. And to help like you live the life that you
that
want, you know.
Group of people, you know, to take care of everything. For them. It's because the illness too, you don't, you know, you've got a lot of things you've damaged in your body with all those drugs and stuff. So your body isn't healthy. You need that health care. If you don't feel good.
So,
you
know, I mean, there's just a whole world of what you need. Yeah. Right. You need a lot of things. You know, someone who was in my shoes, for example, is going to need housing. They're going to need transportation. Yeah. They're going to need clothing, you know, go get a job. Seriously. Hello. Yeah. I don't even know how to live anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and medical care and, you know, all the testing, at least, if nothing else, you know, and psychiatric and all of it. Right. Long-term trauma. So, yeah.
Wow. Girl, that's amazing. From Miami in that schoolyard to look at you today.
Right?
Wow, Siobhan.
I know. Right. And so super, you know, because so recently I it was right before. So this, like in CrossFit, we have this worldwide series of competitions to make it to what we call the games every year. And it's like this open, which is the whole world. And then, you know, the first cut is quarterfinals and the second cut is semifinals. And then there's the open. And I felt really good about the probability that I mean, I knew I would make semifinals. Like I felt really good about that. Didn't know if I'd make top 10 to make the open, but I knew I could make the top couple hundred. And I got 93rd in the first phase. So I was doing good. Right as we're about to enter the second phase, I hurt my back and I couldn't do it. I had to withdraw. And I realized, okay, so I had just put so much pressure on myself.
Yeah.
And part of that I think was because I was focused on me. And my whole, a big part of CrossFit, like, let's not kid ourselves. I definitely like winning a lot, you know, but I've always said, I want to make CrossFit another platform to be able to share, you know, my story and help people. Yeah. So I took a step back and I created this whole Greatness in You, LLC. I just proposed to the Office of Victims of Crimes part of the Bureau of Justice Assistance. They help people who've been victims, right? I just proposed a fitness program, a trauma-informed fitness program, to help people who've been victimized regain their power and their confidence. And fingers crossed, I'm hoping that I get some grant funding to be able to share that. I've got here in a Nashville area, there's a housing, women's housing group that has several women, often takes women who were trafficked. There's a center called Pass the Beauty, who is for victims of intimate partner violence. And there's another treatment center as well that are all interested in doing it if we can get the funding. So fingers crossed. So I'm really trying to, like, you know, bring my CrossFit into and all of it to make it all speak, to all fill my purpose of inspiring others into action.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, I tried CrossFit once many years ago. I was still young and healthy. Oh yeah. I lasted about 10 minutes.
It's hard.
Dear Lord,
I have injuries that I struggle with, but the best cross, like I tell people, if they're going to look for a CrossFit gym, go to the website and go to the gym that has people that look like you, not people who look like you want to look eventually, who look like you today.
That's a good one.
Right. Right. Because, you know, some gyms really just are like, you know, hardcore-ish. Most CrossFits though, it is hard. But most CrossFits and good CrossFit coaches will make the workout something that does challenge you, but is doable. And, you know, I'm a level two CrossFit trainer. And one of the big things that my instructors told us was part of your job is to make this the best hour of somebody's day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm a third degree black belt.
So I get to coach here too sometimes.
Yeah.
Are you? That's amazing.
Yeah. I taught karate for a long time and it was the same way, you know, it's make it fun, make it good. And it's hard, but once you get it, it's like, I taught kids. I love the teenagers and the look in their face, once they get that kick or that hit, they're like, oh, I got it. You know,
That is amazing.
Yeah. I'm a badass too. You never know, huh?
Yeah, you are. No, but of course you are. Are we live? We're not live. We're recording, right?
We're recording. Yeah.
Okay. I just got a notice that my battery's low.
Okay.
Can I just grab a plug? I don't have to turn anything off. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I hope she can.
Sure.
Hopefully she can edit.
Go. Okay. What is the award you got? You got something from the president's office, right? For the work you're doing and raising awareness of opioid addiction. Yeah. Can you tell us about it?
So I was asked by the Bureau of Justice Assistance, a really good friend who used to work there. I met him through the you know, conferences and things. Jefferies, I'll just say his name. Anyway, he asked me to do a presentation for the White House. The White House was doing the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance were doing a joint webinar for sheriff's offices, courts, like all of the judicial, you know what I mean? Everybody around the country about recovery, about the use of medications, just all the things, right? So I was asked to do that, and the director of ONDCP, the drug czar at the time, came on, and he and former director of a Bureau of Justice Assistance awarded me a presidential proclamation signed first term by Donald Trump, just thanking me for my service and for, you know, the work that I've done in recovery. It was pretty amazing. I didn't know it was going to happen. Yeah, it was amazing.
You can't even imagine. What were you feeling? I mean, that's incredible. Like Trump or not.
They made me cry. Whatever, you know. I was like, you made me cry.
Oh, wow. Wow. What a Wonder Woman you are, my dear. Thank you so much for coming on with us tonight. And if someone wants your book, where can they get it? The title of it again? And where can they get it?
So the title of it, so I am but one chapter of eight. So it's called Breakthrough. And you can get it on Amazon. I think it's 99 cents for the digital download. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much, beautiful lady.
If they can't do that, they can always just reach out to me. Can I say my website? I mean, my, which is my email or whatever. It's fine. It's my name, Siobhan, S-I-O-B-H-A-N, at greatnessinyou.life. Just reach out to me and I'll help you get a copy.
Thank you so much. And
thank you for having me. Absolutely. And it's so amazing that you do this for people. Thank you, Dora. It's just such a gift of the heart that you give to everybody. And I think it's wonderful.
Thank you. It's truly a God thing because it wasn't something I seeked out. It she's going to kill me because I always talk about her. Victoria, my awesome producer, her and a friend Stu Shear kept pressuring me that I needed to do this. And I kept No. And I met Victoria and here we are, her superpowers and people like you.
That's awesome. So, Victoria.
Blessings to
you. Anything I can do to support you, you let me know.
Vice versa, girlfriend. All righty. Awesome. Stay blessed.
Thank you. Bye.